Noah.
Hello, hello.
I'm Savannah.
And I'm Alicia.
And this is Burden of Proof.
Welcome. Welcome back.
Welcome back.
Welcome new listeners.
For sure. Well, jumping in today, listen, we've had a lot of really heavy cases recently. We had Amber Smith. We had Eileen Wuornos. We've had Jeff Lundgren. And those were all really hard. And I started to do a case
that was also really hard.
And I was like, I can't do this. My mental health is in the tank because we just needed a break from that stuff.
Yeah, I agree.
And I don't want to make it sound like this case is any less tragic. It is. Don't get me wrong. But
it's true crime.
Right.
And I understand for anybody who's new here. Some of our episodes will be more serious and we can't find the humor. And sometimes we find humor in the ridiculousness.
Right.
Of the crime. Yes. Of the stupidity of the criminal, of circumstances. And it's not to disrespect the dead.
Right.
Or the victims' families. It's simply that we find humor in the absurd.
Yeah. And we try our best to be very respectful of everything. But this case, I don't even know if it's necessarily funny, but it is so dramatic that the reality TV show lover in me was sucked in right away. And I heard it.
So either I am going to find it funny or I'm going to be mad.
I think maybe both. You're definitely going to understand it from the estate planning perspective.
Okay.
So we'll talk about that too. But I will be honest, there's no legal proceedings. So it is very not burden of proof of us, but this is what I was interested in, and I felt like it was a good change of pace.
Okay.
And so I went with it anyway. We'll talk a little bit about estate planning and stuff, though. I will preface, this is an Australia case.
Okay.
We didn't live or work in Australia, so
yeah,
our knowledge of elder law is based on American knowledge, but that's fine.
We can compare to,
right,
you know, the differences maybe.
Right. So, as I just said, we're going to Australia today. Shout out to all of our Australian listeners. We've heard from a couple of you, and that's so cool.
Mm-hmm.
Hello. Let us know if you're listening. It's awesome. And so, let's just cleanse the palate from all this, gore, shall we?
Yeah.
All right.
I'm down.
Starting at the beginning, we will look at Margaret, the matriarch of the Wales family, who was originally born Margaret Lord to parents Doreen and Robert. Now, Robert Lord was a truck driver who would go on to make a literal fortune through road construction and road building. His company was the first to use hot asphalt in building roads.
Oh, wow.
Yes. So they quickly rose through the social ranks and became some of the richest, wealthiest family in all of Victoria.
Okay.
All right. He and his wife, Dottie, raised their two daughters needing for nothing with private education and social graces. He retired and owned quarries throughout Victoria and Western Australia. They were elite members of society, and in the 1950s, Margaret was paving the way through the social scene. She met a dashing young man named Brian Wales, and the day after her 24th birthday, they had a magnificent wedding and rode off into the sunset for their honeymoon. They returned home, and to continue living their lifestyles, they were both from really wealthy families. Margaret's parents actually downsized or moved into a different home, and Margaret and Brian moved into her parents' home. So that's they're maintaining their lifestyle. Now, again, they're both from very wealthy families, and Margaret actually had gone to business school and was very, very intelligent, but she decided to stay home because they very quickly had five children.
Wow.
Sally, Damien, Emma, Prudence, and then the youngest was Matthew. Brian, like I mentioned, was from a well-off family. They needed for nothing. They raised their children in the same luxury that they had been allowed to be raised in. They took very expensive holidays, and their children had private educations. And Brian was a commercial pilot, so they were always jetting around, living the life.
Okay.
'Tis the dream. Until.
Until. Oh, I was going to say, do pilots make... I mean, I'm sure they make good money, but that's not a career path that I would expect from an elite
He was a commercial pilot, so I'm not sure what that means exactly is for his career. I don't know what kind of things he was flying around. You know what I'm saying? Commercial pilots have a very large range of what it could be. Are you flying Amazon packages or are you, you know, who knows? I'm not sure.
Got it.
Because unfortunately, Brian is a secondary player in our story.
Oh, okay.
So.
Well, then we won't worry about Brian.
Yes. The important thing about Brian is that he met a man named Paul and the two became really close friends, like braid each other's hair besties. Brian.
A bromance, if you will.
A bromance, if you will. They met on vacation, but actually they lived really close together. And so when they came home, he introduced him to, I mean, they met on vacation, his wife, but they like all started hanging out.
Is this, wait, I'm sorry to interrupt. Is this a Brokeback Mountain situation?
It's not a Brokeback Mountain situation. How much better would it be?
Because you said there's drama. And I was like, oh, wait a second. Okay.
There is drama, but it's not of that variety.
It really is just a bromance. Okay.
Yeah, it's just a bromance for now. And Brian and Margaret and Paul are all started hanging out. And the children got to see that their parents have a best friend. And, you know, Margaret was alone a lot because Brian traveled all the time. And
or was she? Because she had Paul.
Everybody was really close. And closer. Get closer. And they get closer. Until finally, they were one in the eyes of the Lord. Paul and Margaret were having an affair.
Okay. I was going to say, wait. Are we talking like, I was thinking affair, but
yeah, affair.
Are we talking a throuple?
No throuple here.
Okay.
They didn't divorce right away. They separated for a year, but right after Margaret's father passed away, which secured her inheritance, she and Brian divorced in 1975. Now, I didn't say her children's ages, but they were all born in the late 50s through 1967, and the oldest child was 17 or 18. Sally was about 18 years old. And the youngest, Matthew, was 7.
When they divorced. Gotcha.
Now, this was really difficult for the older children because they had obviously clued into what was going on. Especially because, I mean, their grandfather passed away and within days, Brian was out, Paul was in, they had a new stepdaddy.
Oh, wow. She really...
Very quick. And I mean, they were separated, but Brian was still involved in his kids' lives and all that sort of thing.
Right. But she really was just literally waiting for her inheritance to come through.
Yeah, potentially.
Okay.
And so they really struggled with the transition, especially because, like I said, they were older and eventually they all moved out, you know. But before that, they rightfully disliked Paul because they knew that Paul had been their dad's best friend and then they had this affair. And they're going to not respect that very much, especially when they understand what's going on.
Yeah.
And they acknowledge that there were good times after their parents got divorced and that their mom was really generous during this time and that they took them on all sorts of fun holidays and stuff. But they also acknowledge the downsides, which was that their father was really depressed and his older children unfortunately bore the brunt of that. They talked him through the loss of his wife, his best friend, his home, and also the loss of his youngest child. You see, Margaret was pretty much keeping Matthew away from Brian at this point. From the outside looking in, Matthew really saw his stepfather as his father. I mean, he was 7 years old, and all of a sudden, you know, he's not around his dad. He's got a new stepdad, and, you know, that's hard for everybody, but Matthew, he was really young, so he just kind of moved along with it, you know?
I don't want to downplay divorce in general. My parents' divorce and my husband's parents' divorce when we were around that age... Mm-hmm. But I've also had friends whose parents waited until they were like 18, 19, 20.
Yeah.
And then were like, okay, you're grown. We're divorcing. And it was actually emotionally, it seemed harder for them than it was for us being younger. I think younger kids tend to bounce back because
they're resilient. Yeah.
Yeah. And they tend to go along with however the parents set it up as far as like the parents' dating life or remarriage or whatever. Mm-hmm. The younger you are, the more you adapt to just like, oh, this is just how it is.
Right. Well, and also 7 is kind of a weird, like, when are you aware as a child. If you haven't had some sort of like, and I just preface with like, if you haven't had any sort of early childhood trauma that has forced you to grow up early, let me clarify.
I was going to say, I know my feelings about my parents' divorce was not normal. No. So, yeah.
But like for me, I didn't have early childhood trauma. I had a great childhood. My childhood was banging. And like, at what point are you really cognizant of reality? Like, when are you aware that like, oh, I'm a person? You know, when are you?
When are you aware that your parents are just people?
Right. Seven is really young for that. Yeah. You know, so all that being said, that's the situation. To give you an insight into the dynamics within the new family, I say that with quotes. The older children called Paul the butler or the shadow because of how he acted towards Margaret. He was at her beck and call, always there wherever she went, and was very like subservient is the word that I kept seeing being used towards Margaret. Like that was their life. Now, granted, that's because Paul doesn't come from as much money.
That was going to be my question. Did Paul come from money? Because if not, then it was, that explains it.
I mean, it was hard to tell. He worked in marketing and he lived by himself. He had never married before this. And he's also 5 years older than Margaret. So the dynamic was a little bit weird. But the older children clearly just had like no respect for him. And I 100% understand why at this point in their lives.
Oh, yeah.
You know? Despite all of the good times, when Paul and Margaret finally do get married in 1995, none of the older children are invited to the wedding. Now, they're still, and this is confusing because they're still speaking to their parents and they're still on good terms. But this isn't like a no contact thing. This was just because of the way that they viewed their relationship with Margaret and Paul. Like mom seemingly could separate her relationship with them versus Paul's relationship with them. So they weren't invited to the wedding, but they were still speaking.
Okay. I guess that just the not inviting, like I could see the kids
not going.
I could
going.
Easily see the kids just choosing not to go. But
reportedly, they weren't invited.
Wow.
Yeah. But like they weren't no contact, A, because they loved their mother, and B, like they're set to get this huge inheritance. They're not going to go no contact, even if it's not about money, which for these children, it actually wasn't about the money. They genuinely were very grateful for their mom and everything that they had done. But as we're going to talk about in a little bit, most of the all of the adult children, aside from Matthew, were financially they were completely independent from their parents. They weren't relying on money from the trust. They weren't taking money from their parents. Their inheritance was of no consequence.
Gotcha.
So here, there's the big picture for you.
Okay.
But Matthew was very different than the other siblings. His sister Emma would tell the police, Matthew, this is a quote, Matthew was the baby of the family, and I feel he was mom's absolute masterpiece because he was so beautiful and she was so very into aesthetics. End quote. Other people say that it was her intention to raise Matthew as if he was truly a product of her and Paul. But just because he had this great look does not mean he was a great kid. Matthew and his older siblings never bonded, and on the surface, it may seem that it was due to the parents and the separation, but the older children stayed separate for other reasons as well. Damien is quoted as saying, quote, Matthew was a prick of a kid. We were never close. End quote. His sisters would recall that Matthew was a liar, a manipulator, and would have fits of anger and violent rage. He would have regularly lied to his mother, twisting the words of his siblings, and this continued past his childhood and into his teen and adult years. There were other signs of concerning behavior. I'm not going to go into detail, but his sister would report that he had a tendency for animal cruelty and that when they tried to report this to his parents multiple times, he would pitch fits and manipulate and lie his way out of the situation. But this was not a one-off thing. This happened regularly throughout his life.
I'm scared.
Yeah.
Okay.
He also had a bit of a lower IQ. And he did not do well in school. His outbursts and behavior issues didn't help with that. But he graduated and he went to hair school and he actually did really well for himself right off the bat. Jumping forward a little bit, he would eventually open up his own like hair franchise.
Oh, wow.
From an offshoot of the school that he went to. They owned like they franchised salons.
Gotcha.
And he did this and eventually he had a pretty like, quote, small but loyal following. That's, you know, he was doing fine.
Yeah.
Yeah. At the salon is where he meets his future love, Maritza. Now, Maritza is from Chile, and her and Matthew got on like a house on fire. The two have a short dating period before they get married, but unfortunately, Maritza doesn't mesh into her husband's new family. His siblings and his mother, too, all felt that Maritza was lying and was a gold digger. They felt that she had seduced Matthew for what he would be owed when his mother passed away, and they didn't like her very much at all. Now,
that's saying something if the siblings feel that way, too.
I'm going to say the quiet part out loud. Maritza comes from a very different background. She's an immigrant from Chile. There seems to be some underlying classism or racism here because I could not find any, like...
Okay.
I didn't see a lot of very specific instances as to why they thought that. There were a couple, but I don't think that it was, like, enough. I don't know. I'm just playing devil's advocate here. I'm just saying. I will say I, for the most part, loved the way that his siblings handled everything in the situation. So I don't want to say that that's exactly what's happening, but I do want to just make it clear. These are very different people.
Mm-hmm.
And so it would have taken a lot for them to have had stuff in common.
Okay. Gotcha.
But honestly, I also never saw any indications or vibes that Matthew and Maritza weren't in love. The two seemed to really care for each other. And he even got along with her family. And eventually they would have their only child, and his name is Dominic.
Okay.
Let's get a little bit more dramatic, shall we? The older children had all achieved financial independence from mom. And while Matthew's hair salon was doing fairly well, he still had some help from his family. He lived in a home that was purchased by their family's trust. So he and Maritza lived in this house. And so when they decided that they needed to get a new house, Matthew had to convince his mother to sell the home and give him the profit rather than investing it back into the trust, where he wouldn't see it and he wouldn't have the ability to use it. It was around $140,000 in the year 2000, and that would have been around $250,000 today.
Okay.
Crazy what 22 years of inflation will do.
Mm-hmm.
That's whack. Crack is whack, yo.
That's true.
His mom was really hesitant to just give him $140,000. She was like, you're not really great with handling the money, so maybe we shouldn't. Let me think about it. However, in the end of 2000, Matthew was having some pain, and he got diagnosed with a repetitive use injury in his hand, which would basically end his career.
Yeah.
So he sold his salon, and he filed an insurance claim, and they were living on that. But Maritza wasn't working. She was unemployed. And so they were really tight on money. And after several big fights, Margaret felt that she didn't have a choice. So she sold the home, and she gave Matthew the profits. He used his cash flow to set up a boutique for him and Maritza to run. Once they got the shop up and running, there wasn't much for Matthew to do at the store, so he stayed home with young Dominic. He was a little stay-at-home house husband. Love that for him. And the following year, tensions rose again over familial assets. So follow me here.
Okay.
Their grandparents, Margaret's father, owned a vacation home that was being held in trust, and it was managed by Margaret and her sister, Diana. But the home, the beneficiaries of that trust, was all of the grandchildren.
Gotcha.
So to just make it really easy, the home was technically owned by the grandchildren, but the actual asset was being protected and run and managed by their parents.
Their parents were the trustees.
Yes. Yeah. Now, obviously, I didn't read their trust. Okay, so I'm just reporting, and I'm simplifying for you. Now, Diana's family and their side decided that they wanted to sell the property. The Wales half of the property should have been directed through the trust into each of the children. Right? Should have passed through and gone to them. That's their property. However, Margaret wanted to reinvest the funds into her own trust, saying that, let me reinvest this, your inheritance will get larger, it'll be managed, the money will be managed well, and then you don't have to deal with it. The siblings...
I'm not sure you can do that, Margaret.
If they signed off on it.
If they signed off on it, yeah. But
right. So the siblings, who were all financially independent, were like, no, we're not really relying on your inheritance to get larger for us, and that's our property. By right, we would like the money. And so they were not going to sign off. And so they fought for 2 months over this whole ordeal. And the siblings swore that they would have Matthew on their side because, after all, his family really needed the money from the property at this point. But Margaret swore that he would be on her side as she felt that after all he had done for him, that, like, she was owed his respect and his support. Right? Well, when Margaret, like, shoved the documents at him and they got into a fight about it, he actually signed off on the documents. Now, this spilt over a well of emotions for Mr. Matthew. Okay. Matthew always felt like he was going to be the runt of the litter. He never felt like he was going to succeed, and he always felt stuck underneath his mother's manipulation. He felt that she was controlling him, and that by signing the document, he had further situated himself to be controlled by her forever, especially when he found out that she had already changed the structure of her own will and inheritance and stuff like that. She had structured it so that even after she passed away, the trust had more control over what they did with their inheritance. All of the siblings agreed that this is her continuing to manipulate them financially, even after she's dead. She has to have that control.
And I can attest.
People do it.
People do it.
All the time.
People want to control things beyond the grave. It's quite ridiculous.
Oh, we've seen some ridiculous stuff. I mean, yes. He was very, very upset by that whole situation. And it just kind of pushed him over to the edge where he was like, this is just my life forever. Not to mention, Matthew would very much later tell reporters that Paul was not a good stepfather. He goes on to say that Paul was a pedophile and that he molested him growing up. To be completely fair with you, we have no proof that this is true. None. And he doesn't bring it up until way later. And before he says this, he actually says that he really liked Paul. So I'm just throwing out everything that he said so that you're aware of all of the things that could have been affecting his mentality.
Yeah.
Swimming with all these thoughts, Matthew makes a plan. In March of 2002, Matthew steals some blood pressure pills from Maurizia's mother and invites Margaret and Paul over for dinner. The dinner actually gets rescheduled because Dominic comes down with something. And so it's actually April 4th by the time Margaret and Paul are able to come over.
Okay. That's one of my kids' birthdays.
Oh. That also is premeditation.
Oh, yes.
Paul, like I mentioned, was actually 5 years older than Margaret and had had several strokes within the last 2 years. And unfortunately, he required full-time care. Margaret was taking care of him and enjoyed coming to her son's house to play with her now 2-year-old grandson and honestly to have a little bit of help caring for her husband for the night. He had some speech issues and I'm assuming some issues eating. And so she had help when she came over. They always helped her and she loved playing with Dominic. But Matthew would say that he already saw his mother treating Dominic the same way that she had treated him. And he just knew that if something wasn't done, Dominic would be in the same position that he was, being forced to rely on his grandmother and however his grandmother chose to control their lives. Paul had spent the day... I'm so sorry. Matthew. Paul wasn't doing this.
Paul's sitting in the corner trying to eat his dinner still. Yes.
Matthew had spent the day cooking, crushing pills, making soup, and even putting 2 pieces of wood behind some bushes in the front garden. What a relaxing day to prep for a dinner party.
2 pieces of wood? Okay.
According to Matthew, he was finishing the final preparations with dinner when, and again, this is all alleged, Paul was playing with Dominic in another room. So Matthew comes around the corner and he says that he saw Paul attempt to molest his son. He took Dominic away, gave him to Maritza, and went and finished making his soup. He added crushed pills to 2 of the bowls and brought those out to Margaret and Paul. He said, oh, just go ahead and start. I don't want it to get cold. I'm going to grab the rest of it. So they started eating. They ate, then they had vegetable risotto, and around 9:45, the two tried to leave. They noticed that they didn't feel very well, but likely they were just tired and they wanted to go home. And his wife takes Dominic upstairs to get ready for bed, and Matthew walks his guest outside. Out in the front garden, his mother started commenting on that his garden needed tidying, that he should really fix up these bushes. And as she's speaking, he silently hits her over the head with a piece of pine wood.
this is an interesting way to choose to
right
off your parents.
Yep, he just wanted them weak. So he crushed the pills and then he hit them with wood. Now, they both crumple to the ground with one strike to the back of the head and the neck.
Well, yeah, I mean, how old are they at this point?
Right.
And Paul's already had a stroke, so.
Yeah, he's had a few strokes.
Yeah.
And so once they were down, he continued to beat them until he was sure that they were dead.
Wow.
Right. It's just bizarre.
I don't know. That's just like a brutal way to be like, I'm literally going to beat you to death.
But it just doesn't make any sense. Like, it doesn't, there was no reason to kill them. There just really wasn't. I mean, not that there's ever a reason, but I just mean, like,
why? Yeah, like, Paul had no bearing on the inheritance.
Right.
So.
Right. It just, it's just not, it's not logical. And it continues to just be illogical from here.
All right. Well.
I mean, it's a complicated family dynamic for sure.
Yeah.
But. Help me.
Now, I have a question about the alleged sexual abuse.
Okay.
Because you said it wasn't till later that he said that he was molested or right. sexually abused. But, like, why wouldn't that come up right away? If he claimed that he took his son away from Paul.
That part of the story comes later, too.
Oh, okay.
He doesn't say any of that until right away. Later. Yeah, okay. Until after he's been incarcerated. And
gotcha.
Right.
Okay.
So when he looks up, he realizes he thinks that there's a woman across the street who saw the whole thing.
I mean, yeah, that's not the best laid plan.
So
to be beating people in your front yard.
Well, they had like a fence. So it was really difficult for somebody to see, but he thought that somebody saw him from across the way and that they were going to call the police.
Oh, no. He doesn't go and beat her, too.
He does not. No. He starts to panic a little. And when he turns around, his wife is there because he had left the door open. And so she had put Dominic to bed. She had come downstairs to see where her husband was and like to say goodbye to her guests, but then she gets down there, they're not there. She's like, oh, they probably left but didn't want to come say goodbye because they know I'm trying to put Dominic to sleep.
Mm-hmm.
Which she didn't think anything of that, whatever. When she's passing the door, she realizes it's open. She walks out to the door to go close the front door, and she sees her husband covered in blood over her in-laws' bodies. Now what in the hell would you say to that?
I mean, you might want to make sure your spouse is down with you doing this before you do this in front of them.
So he actually, and I'm skipping ahead, but he actually intentionally moved the wood outside. He had had the pieces of wood like in the atrium of the home.
Mm-hmm.
And then he was like, no, I can't ever do this in front of Maritza. I would never show her that.
How and did he moves you think it you inside. Were going to do it even just outside your front door?
He didn't because he didn't.
Without her seeing something.
Right. He didn't have a plan. Like, he thought he did.
That's insane.
Yeah.
See what I mean? Absurdity.
Right. Considering that he was supposed to, it was like.
Like, how do you not laugh? Like, I'm trying really hard not to laugh because I don't want to say that's terrible. Like, that's a terrible way to go, to literally be beaten to death, even if you are slightly out of it because of being drugged. But.
Right.
It's hard not to laugh at that because it's just so absurd. Like, why would this guy think he's going to get away with this?
Right.
It's so stupid.
I don't have an answer
so
for you.
Stupid.
I don't. You're like,
oh my God.
There's no answer. Stupid. Yeah. Okay. It's so dumb. So she's like, what the hell, dude?
Yeah.
And she's like, what have you done? And he's like, I hit them. I'm so like, I hit them. And she's like, well, no shit.
No shit.
I didn't see that. And she runs upstairs and she actually throws up. She's so distraught by the situation. She's like, yeah. What have you just done? And then she's upstairs with her son. She doesn't know what to think or to do. And the two have what I can only describe as the most intense conversation where she's like, what have you done? What are we going to do? Like, you have ruined everything and you just kill people. That's your why? Who are you? This is not the man that I know.
Yeah.
And he is like, I hit them. I'm sorry. Do you hate me for what I've done? And she's like, I don't even know what you did. Like, why? What is happening?
Do you hate me for what I don't?
She's like, I mean, probably.
She doesn't. I'm processing.
She's processing. That's what she says. She's like, I don't even know. And he's like, I will fix it. And he told her somebody else had already called the police. So she thinks that somebody saw. And then he says, I'm going to fix this. Like, I'm going to fix it. Now, mind you, she has a son in this mix.
How are you going to fix
it? What are you going to do?
What?
So, and the book that I read about this case, the author, I liked the way she put it. She said, before the night was even over, Maurizia had a story that she was told to stick to. And she felt that she had to because of her son and because, like, how do you process this so fast?
And the shock.
Right.
And how would you not fear this man who just beat his parents to death?
Exactly.
Like, that's understandable, at least in the short term.
Right. So after this conversation, he realizes that there's no lights and sirens and that somebody must, like, whoever saw him must not have called the police.
Yeah.
So he decides that he's going to move the bodies. So he does. His older sister, Emma, went several days without hearing from her mother, and this was not the norm. Like I said, just because they were financially independent, they still talked to their mom.
Right.
And she actually had breakfast plans with her mom on the 8th, which was like the next day, because it's been a few days. The last time they were seen was the 4th.
Okay.
So on the 7th, she's expecting a call from her mom the day before to confirm the plans, as she always did. And when Emma didn't receive the call, she got a little bit weird. Her and her husband, whose name is also Damien, which is kind of confusing. Her and her husband.
Because one of her brothers is Damien.
Yes.
Okay.
So her and her husband, Damien, are on their way home from their vacation house when she's like, you know, I'm just going to find a phone. I'm going to call and check in. So she calls her. She doesn't answer. She's like, that's kind of weird and whatever. They get home. And later that night, she decides that she just has a really bad feeling. And her and her husband go over to her parents' house or to her mom and stepfather's house.
Yeah.
And she knocked, but she got no response. But, I mean, she's her daughter. She has a key. So she just lets herself in to check around.
Mm-hmm.
And she's like, well, they didn't go out of town or anything because all of mom's, like, night creams and stuff are still here. And the bed is turned down. Like, they're going to come home tonight. They're probably just out. It's just really late for them to be out.
Yeah.
But their car's not here. It's probably fine. The next day, Emma gets a call from one of her friends who had actually also been trying to get in touch with her mom and hadn't been able to for 3 days. So she was like, hey, girl, is your mom okay? Like, I've been trying to get in touch with her. I need the name of that painter or something. I don't know why she needed to get in touch with her. But is she good? What's up? What's up, Holmes?
What's good?
What's good? Hey, how you doing?
How
you doing? And Emma's just like, you know, this is the last straw. We're going back over there. So her and Damien go back over to try and see, like, did they come home? And it was very clear that they had not come home that night.
Yes.
The bed was the same. Everything was exactly where they left it. And the car was still not there.
Mm-hmm.
So they call the police and she calls all of her siblings, sans Matthew. And her husband start creating a list of friends and family that may have had any ideas of their whereabouts or plans or what was going on. Like, who may have they talked to? Where could they have gone?
Right.
And when she's looking around the house, she sees on the calendar that on the 4th, they had plans with their friends, the Roaches.
The Roaches.
So when she calls and gets a hold of Mrs. Roach, her name is Janet, she tells Emma that she said, oh, your mom mentioned that they had dinner plans that night, but I can't remember with who they said they were going to dinner. So she's like, okay, we've narrowed it down. We have a missing piece. They were at least seen the afternoon of the 4th.
Right.
Where do they go for dinner? And so none of the siblings had even thought to call Matthew yet. Like, none of them. Because they don't talk to him.
Gotcha.
So they're all looking. They're like, well, we're all here. She's not with any of us.
Nobody knows where she is.
Yeah, who knows? And detectives come and they start talking to Janet Roche as well. And when they're talking to her, this time Janet's like, oh, actually, you know, she said she had plans with her daughter that night. And so Emma's like, well, none of us had plans with her. So, oh, wait, wonder if she means Maritza. Maybe she meant her daughter-in-law. And they're like, oh, yeah, we have another brother. We should probably call him. Who's actually closer to mom than we are. Weird. I just thought that was...
Family
dynamics. I just thought it was funny.
Yeah.
She calls Matthew and she's like, when was the last time you saw mom and Paul? And he was like, oh, yeah, they came over for dinner the other night. And she says, and they got there? And he says, yeah, they did. And she says, okay, you need to come to mom's house right now. Doesn't tell him anything else.
Mm-hmm.
And he shows up. When he gets there, he acted perfectly normal. No. He acted very dramatic. He was like immediately holding his head. He was like moaning. He was like, where is my mama? Where is my mama? And the police were like, we haven't even told you what's going on. Like, you have no idea what's happening. None of his siblings were distraught. They were all very well put together people. And they're like, okay, well, we just have to start working the case. Like, where did they go? Nobody had told him anything. And he shows up and he's just like, crying, shaking.
Just, yeah,
very erratic. He can't talk to them. And they're like, okay, so what time did they come to dinner? He's like, it's all a blank. I can't do this right now. Just very upset.
Even that, like, sounds terrible. This is, see, the absurdity. And then I want to sit there and go, no, what you should have said, this is how you get away with murder.
This is how you get away with
what
murder.
What you should have said was, yeah, we were supposed to have dinner. And
they never showed.
They never showed, and I couldn't get a hold of them.
I always wondered why he said that they came to dinner, why he didn't just say they didn't.
Yeah.
But, yeah, he said they did, and that he waved them off. He waved them goodbye. From the driveway, like a good son. Still, I don't know.
I can't wait to hear what he did with the bodies in the car.
Oh, God. Yeah, you really don't want to know that. It's actually really brutal. Emma was like, okay, well, you're clearly a hot freaking mess. Let me call your wife. Like, maybe she's not a hot freaking mess.
Maybe she can get you under control.
And so she calls Maritza. And Maritza's like, yeah, I don't really know what time they left, because I had gone up to, like, deal with Dominic. I don't know what time they left. And she's like, you have no idea. Like, what time does your kid go to bed? You have a 2-year-old. Like, what time does he go to bed? Because what time did they leave? And she's like, I don't know. No idea. Is Matthew there? Can you tell him to come home? I have a headache. She's what? Like, no, he's not coming home. Okay, bye. Like,
oh boy. Okay.
So they leave for the day. Everybody goes their separate ways. And the next day, the siblings all gather together and they start talking. Again, they don't tell Matthew right away. They start. And
well, he's clearly not helpful.
Right. So. And eventually someone was like, yeah, we should probably call Matthew. So Damien, the brother, starts calling Matthew.
Yeah.
But no, he's not answering. He's like, that's really weird. And so they start talking about Matthew's behavior and his reactions, and like Damien just starts thinking like, this just doesn't feel right, like something is wrong. And Damien's the one who said that he was a weird kid,
that he was a prick of a kid,
a prick of a kid. And he was like, yeah, I'm really sus.
I don't trust that prick of a kid.
Yeah, he's like, I don't trust him. So he calls the detectives back and he's like, hey, I would really think that you should maybe look at my brother. Like, we can't get a hold of him. He's not answering his phone. Mm-hmm. And at this point, it's like later in the evening. They'd been together all day. They hadn't been able to get a hold of Matthew. And so the police are like, yeah, we'll go over there. We'll just treat it like a wellness check and see if he's like answering, or did he like take off or something. So they show up and the house is completely dark. And they ring the doorbell a few times. And finally, the couple comes to the door and it looks like they had just woken up. And I'm not exactly sure what time it was. It was like in the evening, but it was just kind of a weird.
Yeah.
It was weird that they were asleep, so not a normal time. Yeah. And when they start talking about why they were there, like, hey, your brother was a little worried. And Matthew's like, oh, I took a sleeping pill because I'm just very upset by this whole situation. And he's like, yeah, well, they've been calling you, trying to talk about it, and you're not answering. He's like, I just couldn't handle it. So theoretically, you're saying that you don't know where your mom is. You're very upset. But your siblings are calling to try and update you and you're not answering. What if they had found her?
Yeah.
Like, I don't think a normal person is taking a sleeping pill right now. Like, I can see a normal person taking a sleeping pill in like 3 days if they haven't slept and they really need to. You know?
I could see somebody taking a Xanax.
Right.
But not a sleeping pill.
He said he had taken a sleeping pill.
Yeah. That's.
Right. So it was just weird. The next day. It's your little timeline. The next day. The whole family gets together. This time, Matthew and Maritza are invited. And as soon as they get there, Matthew's theatrics begin, his performance, his stage. And this time, none of the children cared or believed him. I think it was Emma that was just like, yeah, I had no sympathy. I couldn't. She's like, it sounds horrible, but I could not care that he was upset. Like, he just looked ridiculous. Because at this point, they're all suspicious.
Yeah.
And the police started looking into Matthew, and they realized that their financial position was not great, that the boutique was not doing very well. So they have that in the back of their heads, not to mention what Damien had already said.
Yeah.
And later, Matthew goes to the police department, and he shows up with these basically like handwritten transcripts of what they had talked about at dinner that night on April 4th. He's like, yeah, I've just been thinking about it. So this is everything that we talked about. And on one hand, I can see how that would seem helpful if you were innocent, but it's really weird when you know that he's guilty.
Even if you did that for yourself, like even if you were innocent, even if you did that for yourself, like you thought it through.
Right.
And you wrote it down just to like get everything straight or clear or try to like help jog your memory right. to see like, did they say anything weird or, you know, right. puzzling. But if there was nothing puzzling or weird or whatever, why would you take, you wouldn't take right. it to the police.
I mean, listen, I can see how if you were innocent and you were just like, I really just want to help. Like, I wonder if there's anything in this conversation we had that like points to where they may have gone. Maybe. But it's just stupid knowing that he was guilty and that he knew there was nothing in those conversations. And yet he's like, yeah, let me write down all of the things we.
Yeah.
It's just weird.
You're trying too hard.
Right. Right. Very much a pick me. Pick me murderer.
Yeah.
The biggest pick me murderer is BTK. But well, anyway.
Yeah.
He was very overprepared and very performative the entire time. And while he was there, detectives go to the store to visit with Maritza. She had also written a statement about dinner. And it was 5 pages long. And she basically said that they came and they left.
It was 5 pages, but just they came and yeah. they left.
It was a lot of like little details, like what they had and stuff like that. Hmm. And like they're playing with Dominic and et cetera.
Okay.
The day after, the police held their first press conference about the situation. And this, of course, led to lots of tips. But the most important one was a man who thought he had found their missing Mercedes. Because remember, they drove there. There's mm-hmm. a car.
Yeah.
On April 6th, when he was walking his dog, he saw this really nice Mercedes in his neighborhood and there was no parking sticker. He's like, that's weird. They obviously don't live here.
Mm-hmm.
And so he kept walking his dog and he wouldn't have thought anything about it, but it was still there for days. And so when he saw the police talking about it, they had said the plate numbers. So he wrote them down and he went outside and he checked and that Mercedes is still there. It had the matching plate numbers.
Mm-hmm.
So he was like, yeah, there it is. So they found the Mercedes. There were no prints when they picked it up, though. There was no evidence inside the car. It had completely been cleaned. It was just a car.
Yeah.
Other residents of the neighborhood can actually also verify that they saw the car, and they can place it there as early as April 5th, which would make sense because they died the night of the 4th.
Right. So he just drove it to a neighborhood.
Yeah. And just left it there.
And left it.
Mm-hmm.
In a decent neighborhood.
Right.
Not like a sketchy part of town.
Right. And here's your little tidbit at the very end of the episode, or it may be on Patreon, however you want to cut it. Little story, side story. We're going to talk about...
Sidebar.
We're going to talk about some of the really weird paranormal aspects of this case. So if you're into ghosties, check that out. So anyway, they were like, okay, so we've at least found the car and they're not in the car. So pretty sure this is homicide at this point. They'd also like looked in the home and realized that it wasn't a robbery or a ransom situation because nothing of value was missing. So they knew that was not part of
mm-hmm.
it. And the detectives go back to Matthew and Maritza's home. And while they're talking, some of the officers start looking around. They don't see anything, but in the garage, they notice that Matthew's car had a very strong chemical smell. A few weeks later, on April 29th, detectives got word from park rangers in the Yarra Forest that officers had found a grave containing two bodies. It was right off of a path, like path number 3. Okay. In the grave, they found 3 cinder blocks, which were covering a deflated child swimming pool, and that contained fabric bags that had the two bodies of Paul and Margaret. They were able to see cause of death and ruled it as homicide. They were advanced in decomp because, again, this is Australia in March.
Yeah.
Although, the seasons are flipped there. Either way, it's hot. It's Australia.
Yeah.
And based on stomach contents, they could actually tell that they had been killed very quickly after eating at Matthew's because they knew what they had had for dinner.
Mm-hmm.
This is why you should have said you didn't know they didn't come to dinner, Matthew. Then you didn't know what they had for dinner.
Mm-hmm.
It wouldn't have mattered, though. There's plenty of other evidence.
I figured.
Yeah.
But
when the detectives pulled the family together to inform them, they would then pull Matthew aside and hand him a search warrant for his home. They immediately go and find a bunch of things that match that were found in the grave, such as chains that were wrapped around cinder blocks, green string that had been used on the necks of the bodies, because he had also strangled them at some point. A matching set to the children's pool that they had found in the grave, a recently used shovel, and matching bed sheets and bedding that the bodies had been wrapped around. I think it was a quilt cover. So they've got plenty, my dudes. But they have to take all this stuff and process it.
Right.
So while they're processing this, and before it was done, a funeral was held for Margaret and Paul. Tensions were high. Matthew's performance began yet again. And at this point, the siblings also knew that he was refusing to submit a DNA sample. Now, I don't know if you've caught on, but these siblings are not quiet. And they were just like, why? Why won't you give them a sample? Like,
yeah,
what's going on? And when asked, he would just say he was protecting his family and then start crying. So, mind you, this, like, we call it the society murders because these people were important. Like, people knew who they were. They were like mini Kardashians, basically. In Australia, mm-hmm. And it was really a popular case. And the press and the public already knew that his home had been searched, and they had already basically decided he was guilty. Like, everybody knew. So they were being followed everywhere they went. Their house was being staked out all the time by reporters. Like, this is a really big deal. And obviously, Matthew and Maritza were struggling because it's really tense. She has a baby to worry about, and she's, like, at this point, she knows what happened. She's just stuck lying about it because of Matthew and his behavior.
Right.
And so she meets with her attorney and they decide to set up a meeting with detectives. And there she tells the detectives everything and she signs a statement.
Good for her.
Yes. On May 11th, he was arrested and he confessed it to police. He mentioned that he buried his mother lower than his stepfather to diminish her domineering presence, he says. He also said that he blamed Paul for his parents' separation and that's why he killed him, although he would later say, well, I rather liked Paul. But then later, he would say that he was a pedophile and molested him and was hurting his son. So what is it, Matthew?
Did he say that after he was convicted?
I believe so.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm. So, at the Victoria Supreme Court, Matthew pled guilty and was convicted of the murders. He was sentenced to 30 years and was available for parole after 24. The trial judge found that due to his low intelligence, he murdered the couple because he resented his mother, especially over all of the will situations mm-hmm. and the estate planning. His wife pled guilty to attempting to pervert the course of justice, and she received a 2-year suspended sentence. And she was able to post bond, so she was not actually incarcerated. And she was found to not have played any part in the actual murders. The Wales siblings were very upset because they thought that Maritza was more involved than it seems. They are still saying this. They're very, very adamant that she was involved. Oh. But the judge and the police and everybody involved says that there is absolutely no evidence linking her to the crime and that her story and Matthew's story, when separated, actually line up really well. So
yeah,
there's enough differences for it to not look rehearsed, and there's not enough differences for it to look like she was involved. And there's no physical evidence that she was involved either.
Right.
And also, her behavior is just very... I mean, yeah, she should have gone to the police right when it happened, but at the same time, she was in such shock that, like, what do you do?
I don't think that's strange.
I don't blame her in the slightest for the way she behaved, honestly.
Yeah, I don't think that's strange, especially if, I mean, because the siblings weren't in touch with them, so they don't know what his behavior was like towards his wife or his son,
right,
or whatever day to day. So if he was like temperamental with her, or she had any sort of fear that he could snap at any moment, who knows?
We don't know.
And then he does something like this, like she would have been terrified.
Well, and they said that they thought that Maritza was really domineering. Like, they felt that he had just left one domineering woman to go marry Maritza and be with another domineering woman. And like, they thought it was weird that he called her mama, which it's not that weird in a lot of cultures.
And especially like,
she's from Chile.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was going to say, especially like Hispanic Latin cultures, I've heard.
Yeah, it's not uncommon at all.
Yeah.
And so they felt that she was really like the brains of the operation, but that just wasn't, I don't think, the reality. I personally think she had nothing to do with it.
Yeah. I don't know. Why wouldn't he turn on her? If she turned on him and turned him in, why wouldn't he be like, well, wait, she made me do it.
You know? And he swears up and down that she never had anything to do with it.
Yeah.
And I do think that he was probably telling the truth when he says that he originally was going to do it inside, but then was like, no, I don't want to show that to Maritza ever. I'll just do it outside.
Yeah.
Because the whole thing was so poorly planned. Why would he lie about that part of the planning process? That just doesn't make any sense.
Yeah. Definitely poorly planned.
For sure. You want to talk about ghosts?
Okay. Sidebar.
So there's some theories. Some theories. A lot of people came forward and said that they had seen Margaret around the car and like around town after the murders. One man even said that like it was near the car and that she had like made eye contact with him, and they had like a moment where they looked at each other, and it was like her saying, pay attention to this vehicle. Pay attention to me here.
Spooky.
So spooky. And it was not just one person. It was a lot of people coming forward and saying like, no, but I saw her on the 6th. I saw her on the 7th. Like, I saw her on the 5th that evening or that morning. Like, when I was walking, she would, like, people were like, she was around.
Spooky.
Another theory I saw is that the person that Matthew saw watching him, he saw it was a woman, but he didn't see who it was. And a lot of people think that it was her ghost right after he killed her, watching him, making him paranoid, saying, like, I'm going to get you.
Ooh. That's creepy.
So creepy.
Oh, that's creepy. Ugh. That's creepy.
Freaky.
I think I would be terrified of that. I think if I ever, like, snapped and killed somebody,
they would follow
you. I
don't
think I would, but... But I think after the fact, that's how I would go down, is because I would like be institutionalized, because I'd be so paranoid that I'm being haunted by their ghost.
It's like telltale heart situation.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Ugh. Creepy.
I just think it's weird that people who had no idea that she was dead, they were like, no, I saw her. And like somebody that she knew. Like, one of her friends. Because remember, they parked that car in a neighborhood that, like, that car was way too nice to be in that neighborhood kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. But it wasn't a terrible neighborhood.
No, it was a normal. It was just normal.
Yeah.
Because they had parking stickers. It was a gated high community.
Society.
It just was. Right.
Yeah.
And so they were like, you know, this is, like, bougie even for here. And they're like, yeah, no, I saw her. She waved at me. We made eye contact. Like, it's so weird.
Creepy.
Ooh. I thought that was a fun tidbit, and I thought it was a good palate cleansing case from all of the gore we've had.
Again, with the absurdity, I just, like, what?
Very poorly planned crime. And also, some of the park rangers were like, yeah, I mean, you can tell this guy had never been in the bush, because whoever did this has no idea where they are in this park, because this was, like, right off the path. He was like, oh, what was he doing? He was marking things with rocks, the officer who found it.
Mm-hmm.
And he was like, oh, it looks like a bird's nest, because it was like there's a kind of bird that nests in the ground like that in that area. And he's like, oh, that's so fine. And he keeps going. And then he goes back and he starts thinking about it. He's like, yeah, I just have a weird feeling about it. So he goes and gets another ranger, and they go out there together with rakes, and they just kind of wanted to poke and see if it was a bird's nest. And then when they were like, oh, that's a cinder block, they were like, okay. So they kept going and they found.
That's probably not good. Yeah. Yeah.
But I just, this case, the all of the different people being like, yeah, I just had a weird feeling. Like, it just felt off.
Mm-hmm.
I saw her. Like, Emma having a weird feeling, and her friend being like, yeah, I couldn't get in touch with her. There was just a lot of, you know.
a lot of intuition going mm-hmm. on.
And a lot of ghosts.
Or one ghost.
Just one ghost. That
was very active.
Yeah, because I don't think, like, I mean, obviously most murder victims aren't ready to go, but she was, like, not unhealthy. She was a very strong woman. Mm-hmm. She was still, like, that morning, the morning of the 4th, she had met with her bookkeeper. They had gone over their portfolio for, like, 2 hours, and then she had lunch with some friends, and then she was taking care of Paul, and then she took Paul to dinner. Like, she was still a really active social woman. Mm-hmm. So I think she was pissed that she was dead.
I mean, I would be pissed that I'm dead.
I think most people would be pissed that they're dead, yeah.
Wow.
Right.
You have to be careful, though, honestly.
Yeah.
You have to be careful if you're going to try and be controlling.
Yeah, don't tell anybody about your documents ever.
Your estate plan. If you're going to be that, yeah, you do.
Don't tell anybody.
Because that's a whole...
Especially if you have, like, weird family dynamics like mm-hmm. this was just bizarre.
Well, that's been my experience in working in that field, is that it's usually when there is weird family dynamics and or it's a second marriage.
Mm-hmm.
I hate to say it. Listen, I know this isn't, like, real science. It's not, like, a study. But I worked in the field for a few years.
And in our area... I know what you're saying.
And it was very rare that husbands would come in and be the one to be controlling. And when that was the case, it was usually with a couple that had been, they'd only been married yeah. to each other. And it was because of family dynamics and stuff. I had a couple cases that the parents were very controlling, particularly the wife was very controlling over the trust and stuff, because they had at least one child that was just not very responsible right. with money. And I understand, but at the same time, you're gone. You're going to be right. gone. Like, just there's nothing yeah. you can do. Like,
I think the biggest thing is, like, when it comes to second marriages and third marriages, estate planning goes a little bit awry. A lot mm-hmm. of people just have, like, weird dynamics, and it is way more common than you think that this situation happens.
The other reason, like, any of us in the field know that it's pointless for, or almost pointless, for one spouse or the other to try yeah. and be so controlling, is that, guess what? If you die first, your spouse can go and change everything yeah. anyway, so it doesn't matter.
At least in Florida, like, if you do them together, if you go in as a husband yes. and a wife and you do everything together, whoever dies, the next person can just change it. You don't want that to happen. You have to do it separately, and that's a pain in the butt.
Yeah. If you want to leave everything to your spouse, right. if you set it, I should specify that. If you set it up so that, well, if I die, everything, you know, then my spouse just, like, right. has it, but then they're supposed to split it this way once they die. Yeah, no, they can change it. Mm-hmm. So, you know.
And again, we're not attorneys.
We're not attorneys, but that's
just what we know.
That's just how it be.
Yep.
That's how it be. So you take that information and do what you will with it. You take that information to an attorney and you ask the right questions.
Yes. Well, thank you very much for indulging my reality television case today that I just thought was a good one for us this week. It kept my attention. Absolutely. I hope it kept yours. And if you made it this far, please leave us. There's, like, a little, like, paper scroll, like, old-timey legal-looking mm-hmm. document emoji. Leave us one of those under any social media post, and you'll be entered in for Sunday shout-outs.
Yes. Thanks for listening. If you like what you heard...
Yeah.
Whether you're a new listener or a regular listener or semi-new listener, wherever you fit, one of the best ways that you can help indie podcasters is by leaving a review or a rating,
mm-hmm.
especially on the big platforms like Apple and Spotify. So, yeah.
Yeah.
If you feel we deserve it, go ahead and leave us a nice review.
Yeah. Thank you. We love you when you do that.
Well,
I love you all the time.
We love you anyway for listening.
I meant so. We love it when you do it, but it just sounded weird when I said it.
It sounded pervy.
I'm not trying to be pervy, okay?
I'm just kidding. Anyway, thanks for listening.
Thank you, guys. We'll talk to you next week.
Till next time.
Bye. Bye. Thanks for listening, guys. Find us on Instagram and TikTok at Burden of Proof Pod and email us at burdenofproofpod@gmail.com.